Nemoto presents pioneers of psychology and psychiatry. Sigmund Freud, The Unconscious Speaks. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 24 minutes. Today we begin with a truly remarkable man whose name turned into a language, Sigmund Freud. You do not need to be a clinician to speak it. You can live far from any academy and still say without thinking, Freudian slip, ego, or repression. The way one says gravity without studying Newton. That is the reach of the project Freud began, to turn the private weather of the mind into public speech, to map a territory that had been treated as superstition or shame, and to insist that the symptoms that ruin lives often disguise stories that can be told, heard, and, with luck, relieved. Freud seen as late 19th century Vienna, a world of polished salons and rigid manners, where the public mask is everything and the private self often suffocates behind it. He is a physician by training, an observer by temperament, and a skeptic by habit. He had begun his career in research, studying the anatomy of the brain and even experimenting with new chemical remedies, but it was at the bedside that Freud found his true calling. In the hospitals of his day, he sees patients, mostly women, suffering from strange, nervous disorders with names like hysteria or neurasthenia. These diagnoses sound like Latin and feel like shrugs. If a limb went numb or a voice was lost with no obvious organic cause, the patient was often told it was nothing or that it was just nerves. Victorian medicine had little to offer beyond rest cures or dubious tonics. But Freud refuses the nothing. He stares at the gap between what the body does and what the body should be able to do, and he asks a forbidden question. Asterisk, what if this paralysis is a message? What if symptoms speak? Asterisk. Under the influence of mentors who study hypnosis, Freud tries at first to command the symptom to depart. He had visited the famous neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot in Paris and seen hysterical blindness or paralysis temporarily relieved under hypnotic trance. Perhaps suggestion could banish the problem. Sometimes it does seem to vanish, but more often the symptom returns or it migrates to a new form. The failure is instructive. If a hypnotic command silences a symptom and the symptom comes back, perhaps the point is not to silence it but to let it speak in a different register. Freud, together with an older colleague Joseph Breuer, begins experimenting with a radical tool, conversation. They invite the patient to talk, to say anything that comes to mind without censorship. Freud calls this technique free association. The healer's task is to follow the threads of apparently random thoughts, to notice where the tongue trips or refuses to go, to gently hold attention on whatever memories arise when no one is forcing them to be orderly. In that permissive space, burdened emotions begin to move, scenes that had been repressed, pushed out of awareness, re-enter consciousness. A body that had been saying no with numbness begins to say yes with words. One patient famously dubbed this process the talking cure, capturing the essence of Freud's approach, healing through saying what was once unsayable. This was the birth of Freud's creation, psychoanalysis. He also soon discovered that the therapeutic relationship itself could stir up the very emotions under examination. Patients would sometimes develop intense feelings toward Freud, affection, anger, even childlike dependence, that didn't quite fit the reality of the doctor's office. It was as if they were transferring emotions from an earlier figure in their life onto the person of the analyst. Instead of dismissing this phenomenon, Freud made it central to his technique, calling it transference and using it as a window into the patient's inner world. By observing and gently interpreting the emotions a patient directed toward him, he could illuminate the hidden patterns of the patient's past relationships and conflicts playing out in real time. Out of hundreds and eventually thousands of hours at the couch, Freud extracted a few essential principles about the human mind. First, the psyche is not a monarch but a coalition, a kind of parliament of impulses that do not always vote in the same direction. We often experience wishes and fears that directly conflict with one another. Second, the self is largely opaque to itself. We hide things from ourselves without knowing we are doing so. We defend against memories or feelings that threaten our cherished image of who we are. We rationalize, deny, project, and forget, not because we are malicious or weak, but because consciousness is a small raft on a deep sea. Third, language, dream language, symptom language, slips of the tongue and little jokes and nervous tics, betrays the pressure of what we cannot easily say. Freud famously called dreams the royal road to the unconscious, implying that if we learn to read their strange imagery and illogical stories, we can discover hidden truths about ourselves. In short, if you want to reach the truth of a person, you must listen not just to what is said but how it is said, and also to what is not said at all. In 1900, Freud published a book that would change the understanding of the mind, The Interpretation of Dreams. It was a daring work, opening with the analysis of Freud's own dreams and proposing that a dream is the disguised fulfillment of a repressed wish. Most of his medical colleagues at the time greeted this idea with disbelief or indifference. After all, dreams were regarded as meaningless by science. But Freud insisted that the capricious dramas of our sleeping minds could be decoded. He described how dreams have two levels: the manifest content, the bizarre narrative or images we remember upon waking, and the latent content, the hidden meaning, often tied to an unconscious wish or conflict. To get from the manifest to the latent content, the mind employs dream work, processes like condensation, combining multiple ideas or people into a single symbol, and displacement, shifting emotional emphasis from an important idea to a safer one. By analyzing these processes and free associating to elements of a dream, Freud believed we can uncover the unconscious material hiding in plain sight. Although The Interpretation of Dreams was not an overnight success, Freud considered it his most significant book, a foundation stone of psychoanalysis. It was his royal road into the unconscious, mapped out for anyone willing to follow. Freud was not content with a method. He wanted a model, something an ordinary person could picture to make sense of the mind's architecture. His first model, suggested in that dream book and other early writings, was topographical. He said the mind is like an iceberg. The small part floating above water is the conscious mind. Just below the surface is the preconscious, thoughts we aren't thinking about at the moment but can easily bring to mind. And deep below lies the vast unconscious, filled with thoughts and desires we do not know we have. This image captured a radical idea. Most of the mind's activity is hidden from us. Years later, Freud offered a second model that became even more famous. In 1923, in a work called The Ego and the ID, he reframed the psyche as a kind of conflicted city-state with three main forces. One he called the ID, a seething cauldron of raw desires, seeking pleasure and demanding immediate satisfaction. Another he called the superego, essentially an internalized set of rules, prohibitions, and ideals, the stern voice of conscience and social norms, largely inherited from parents and culture, standing in strict judgment. And trying to negotiate between these two was the ego, our conscious self, the planner and mediator that must deal with reality, attempting to satisfy the ID's demands in socially acceptable ways while also heeding the superego's moral constraints. In this structural model, the mind becomes a battlefield or a negotiated treaty between desire and duty, between impulse and restraint. The metaphor has its limits, but it gives shape to the struggles a person might feel when, for example, the heart wants what the rules forbid, or when one's guilt and ideals choke off one's basic needs. Freud's models and metaphors were attempts to explain what he was observing in his consulting room, observations that by the 1920s had captivated and divided an international audience. And what he observed, above all, was conflict. Conflict between what we want and what we allow ourselves to want, between various parts of our own psyche. This inner conflict, in Freud's view, is the source of much psychological distress. A symptom, a panic attack, a suddenly paralyzed hand, an inexplicable phobia, often sits at the intersection of opposing forces. The person may not consciously understand why they have the symptom, but if the symptom could speak, it might tell a story of a conflict left unresolved or a feeling that had no other way to express itself. To understand one example of how Freud's ideas can illuminate human behavior, consider the problem of addiction. Freud himself did not write extensively on substance addiction as we think of it today, yet his concepts give us a unique lens on it. To look at addictive behavior in a Freudian light is to notice two things at once: the relief and the repetition. Addictive behavior often begins as a brilliant, if costly, solution. It is like a chemical or behavioral shortcut that quickly dampens anxiety, blunts rage, or fills a hollow loneliness with artificial comfort. In psychoanalytic terms, the substance or habit provides a kind of surrogate regulation. It manages feelings a person has not yet learned to handle, and it symbolically satisfies needs that feel otherwise impossible to voice. In the short term, the drink or the drug or the obsessive behavior works. It brings relief, solace, or numbness. But then the solution becomes a problem of its own. The cost mounts, the relief diminishes, and so the person finds they must do the same thing again and again. Repetition takes over. Freud named this pattern the repetition compulsion, the tendency to reenact an unresolved hurt or conflict over and over, as if trying in vain to master it. The first high or the first escape might have felt like salvation. The second is elusive, and the hundredth is a miserable necessity. The mind remembers that initial relief and chases it with a fervor that begins to exclude all other pursuits. Freud's gift to anyone trying to help with such a pattern is not a moral sermon but a method of reading a person's suffering. If you ask only, "Why does she drink so much?" you might receive a shallow answer, a moralistic story blaming her character, or a medical explanation pointing to her brain chemistry. In other words, one perspective might condemn her weakness of will, while another might declare she has a brain disease, yet neither approach truly asks what the drinking means to her. If you follow Freud and instead ask, "What problem is this behavior trying to solve?" you open a very different door. Indeed, this shift in questioning forms the basis of much of modern psychotherapy. Instead of merely judging or trying to stamp out the behavior, the goal becomes to understand the need or pain that lies beneath it. Only by seeing what role the addiction is playing in a person's emotional life can one begin to help them find better ways to meet those needs. So you might gently inquire, "What feelings become bearable after the second glass of wine? Which memories go quiet when you reach for those pills? What inner void or tension swells up right before you feel the urge to place another bet or click refresh again?" The answers, if they come, are often painful and deeply personal. For one person, alcohol might silence a lifelong fear of abandonment. For another, a drug might anesthetize the rage that would otherwise explode at the people he most loves. For a third, a compulsive habit like gambling or scrolling on the phone might, for a moment, turn a loud inner critic into a tolerable whisper. Remove the substance or compulsion without addressing these underlying stories, and you remove the person's one makeshift tool for managing their pain. That is why simple exhortations to just stop, or shaming someone for their habit often fail, and why sheer willpower, white-knuckling through craving, often burns out. The work, instead, is to gradually make the buried story behind the addiction speakable, and to help the person discover new tools and supports so they no longer need to rely on the destructive one. Freud's own life offers a cautionary tale without hypocrisy. He was a brilliant healer, yet he was not immune to the lures he described. Early in his career, Freud fell under the spell of what he believed was a miracle cure, cocaine. In the 1880s, as a young neurologist, he experimented with cocaine on himself and sang its praises in medical papers as a stimulant and an antidote for depression and even morphine addiction. He published an enthusiastic article, On Coca, in 1884, convinced that he had found a panacea. He urged his friends and even his fiancée to try it. Famously, he recommended cocaine to a close friend to help wean the friend off morphine. Instead, the friend developed a severe cocaine addiction and later died as a result. It was a tragic lesson. Freud eventually recognized the danger of the drug and stopped promoting it as a cure. But he himself continued to use cocaine in small doses for some years, into the 1890s, to lift his own mood and energy when he felt it flagging. Even the father of psychoanalysis was not immune to the lure of a quick chemical fix for emotional pain. He also smoked cigars incessantly, as if they were air, long after he knew what they were doing to his body. Freud openly called his cigar habit an addiction. And indeed it was. He reportedly smoked 20 or more cigars a day. In middle age, he began to suffer the consequences. In 1923, he was diagnosed with cancer of the jaw, likely a direct result of decades of heavy smoking. Over the next 16 years, Freud underwent 30-plus surgeries and painful treatments, eventually losing a large part of his jaw. He endured disfigurement and constant discomfort, yet he kept working and writing through it all. And he kept smoking, unable or unwilling to ever fully give up the habit that soothed him. It is tempting to make a simple moral of this: even the doctor could not cure himself. But the more important lesson is the limits of insight alone. In one of his own letters, Freud wryly remarked that understandings are cure-alls for very few. Knowing why we are the way we are does not automatically free us from our condition. Understanding the engine does not, by itself, repair the car's brakes. Still, understanding matters. If a patient can link their compulsion to its function, if she can finally say, When I feel small and helpless, I reach for something that makes me feel powerful. When I feel empty, I reach for something that pretends to fill me. Then she has won the first honest inch of freedom from a behavior that thrives in secrecy and confusion. Freud is often caricatured as the man who reduced everything to sex. This is a misunderstanding. True, he placed sexual desire at the center of human motivation, but he used sexual in a very broad sense. He enlarged the concept until it included a whole range of human strivings for pleasure, comfort, connection, and continuity, extending even to childhood attachments and rivalries, the kernel of what he famously dubbed the Oedipus complex. Equally important, he insisted that a person is a historical creature. We do not get to be born anew each day. Our past persists within us, in our habits and postures, in our dread and our hope, in the unspoken rules we inherited from rooms we barely remember. Many of our conflicts and compulsions live at that junction of history and habit. A child grows up learning to manage a parent's volatility by staying very quiet and very good, and decades later cannot sleep without a sedative because her nervous system never learned what safety feels like. A teenager discovers that achievement earns him affection and approval, and later cannot stop working, even dosing himself with stimulants to keep going, because rest makes him feel worthless. A girl is taught early that anger is ugly and unacceptable, and years later she never expresses anger, but she might drink at night to soften the sharp edges of resentment she cannot voice. On the surface, these behaviors look like personal failings or purely physical problems, bad habits, weak will, chemical hooks. But underneath, each is speaking a symbolic language of survival. Each addictive or compulsive act is a coded attempt to provide something essential, safety, approval, release, that was missing or forbidden in the past. If you keep Freud's fundamental insights in mind, then helping someone in psychological pain becomes less about issuing orders or quick fixes and more about careful, compassionate investigation. The process of therapy becomes less punitive and more precise. You help the person identify the emotional function of their symptom or behavior, what it is doing for them. You help them find words for the states of fear, shame, or loneliness that precede it. You widen their repertoire of tolerable feelings so that not every inner twinge automatically triggers the old response. You make room for grief because grief often hides inside the loop of a destructive habit. Grief for what was lost or what was never had or what can no longer be. You help them renegotiate guilt because a harsh inner critic, a punitive superego in Freudian terms, will always sabotage recovery by insisting that relief is a crime and that suffering is the only virtue. And you practice at length the art of waiting, waiting between urge and action, teaching the mind and body that an impulse is not a command, allowing the nervous system to settle into a different rhythm. None of this necessarily requires a couch in a paneled office as Freud's sessions once did. It requires instead the basic stance Freud embodied, a deep respect for symptoms as messages, a belief that much of our conflict is internal and not simply a failure of will, and a conviction that the past is stubborn but not absolute. Change is difficult but not impossible, because once an experience is brought into the light of awareness, talked about openly and understood, it loses some of its power to control us. Freud was also a realist, some would say a pessimist, about civilization at large. In some of his later work, such as Civilization and Its Discontents, he suggested that living together in society forces each of us to pay a cultural tax. We give up certain immediate pleasures and instinctual freedoms in order to gain the benefits of community and to keep the peace. But the suppression of our instincts comes at a cost. The tax breeds resentment, an undercurrent of discontent. And that suppressed resentment is always seeking a way out, a discharge. Some of that energy finds creative outlets, transformed into art, humor, or innovation, what Freud called sublimation. But some of it inevitably turns destructive, either directed outward as aggression or inward as suffering. In this light, an addiction or compulsion can be understood as a private rebellion that unfortunately ends up hurting the rebel most of all. It is a revolt against constraint, a way of saying, I will feel good on my own terms, consequences be damned. But that revolt ends up chaining the person to a narrower and narrower circle of life. Treating such a pattern only as a sin to be punished misses this deeper structure. Treating it only as a medical disease misses the human meanings the person has woven into it. Freud invites us to see even the most baffling or self-defeating behavior as a clue, a cipher to be decoded, rather than just an error to eliminate. It is entirely possible to reject half of Freud's specific theories and yet keep the stance that made them powerful. You can disagree with some of his ideas about dreams or sexuality or the details of childhood complexes, and still hold on to his fundamental approach. The idea that human beings are more than their outward behavior, that our symptoms and idiosyncrasies often have hidden reasons, that speaking aloud can loosen the knots in the psyche that punishment only tightens, and that memory, even painful memory, is not a prison if it can be acknowledged and shared. We can carry forward, too, the profound humility that Freud's work implies about helping others. The sense that in each patient lies a unique complexity that neither the helper nor the helped can fully map or master. Psychoanalysis, at its best, refuses to simplify people. It says, the symptom is the surface of a depth. Let's go down there together carefully and see what's underneath. There is one further Freudian thread worth tugging in our age of engineered distractions. Freud studied the intimate theater of the mind with 19th-century tools. A quiet room, two people talking, a journal of dreams. But we now live amid 21st-century amplifiers, devices and platforms that weaponize the repetition compulsion by design. Think of the endless scroll of a social media feed that never reaches a natural stopping point, keeping us constantly chasing the next hit of novelty or validation. That scrolling feed is like a synthetic transference object, offering the illusion of limitless soothing and connection, while actually extracting our attention as profit. And consider the algorithms that predict when you will be most tempted to engage and nudge you at just that moment. They function like invisible superegos, pressuring behavior by rewarding compliance and punishing defiance with the anxiety of missing out. If Freud were here today, he would not simply moralize about our screen addictions or scold us for lack of self-control. He would ask, as always, what problem the behavior solves. What longing or fear is being momentarily eased by that late-night binge online, and how have our modern merchants of attention cleverly exploited it? He would remind us that the dignity of a person lies not in never having unhealthy urges, but in being able to understand and choose. And he would surely say that the voice which heals is not a shout or a lecture, but a conversation, a space where someone can name their hunger without immediately being judged for it, and thus start to find better nourishment. Freud never promised an easy cure for the human condition, but he offered a direction, a method, and a kind of hope. He taught us to listen deeply, to interpret generously, and to give voice to the hurts that lie beneath the surface of behavior. In his view, genuine understanding, truly illuminating the hidden story, is the first step on the path to freedom. So we end where Freud often began, in a quiet room, two chairs, or perhaps a couch and a chair, and a hard truth that becomes a little more bearable because it is spoken and heard. The psychoanalytic wager, then and now, is that insight, honesty, and compassion can transform suffering. It is not a quick fix, not a cure-all, but in a world addicted to quick fixes, it remains a profound alternative. With all our pharmacology and data and brain science, Freud's wager is still worth taking seriously, that by exploring and owning our inner life, our desires, our fears, our memories, we can, bit by bit, enlarge the scope of our freedom. And indeed, each time a modern therapist offers someone that quiet, safe space to speak and be heard, or each time we ourselves pause to wonder what hidden story might lie behind a feeling, a habit, or a slip of the tongue, we are echoing Freud's legacy, carrying forward his faith that understanding brings relief.